thank you very much, Chair, and our sincere apologies. The Secretariat just put on the wrong electronic version, but the hard copies that you have received is not Secretariat of Parliament, sorry, our own. The hard copies that you have are the correct presentation. I just need to say, perhaps when we go along, there may be desire to compare what we are presenting with what the parliamentary support staff presented in the morning. I just must say that the difference is that we are showing a comparison between what was the indicative figures for the MTEF period against what was the final allocation for 2014-15. So as you do that comparison, you may see serious differences. It's because we are not comparing apples with apples. They dealt with the, like I was saying, they dealt with the final adjusted budget of 2013-14 and the budget of 2014-15, whereas we are showing the indicative figures that were meant for 2014-15 against the final allocation of the same year of 2014-15. Just analyzed per program, slide number 2, we are just showing the administration, the indicative figure before the MTEF processes were finalized was 1.2 billion rand. We ended up in 2014-15 as a final budget allocation for administration at 1.1 billion rand. In program number 2, Geospatial and Cadastral Services, we had an indicative figure of 804.8 million rand. We ended up with 774.8 million rand. In rural development, we had 2.1 billion as indicative. We ended up with 2 billion rand as a final allocation for the year of 2014-15. Restitution indicatively was 2.9 billion. We ended up with 2.6 billion rand. Land reform was not changed. It was always 2.818386 billion rand. We got the same amount for land reform as the final budget allocation. We also just decided to show the budget share on our programs. You'll remember that the administration program is really the program where we spend money to facilitate the work of the department. So the administration program is not really the core program of the department, hence you will see that it only gets 12.4% of the total allocation of the budget of the department. Geospatial and Cadastral Services Program 2, that's one of the core programs of the department. It gets 8.2%. Rural Development Program 3 is one of our main programs, gets 21.3%. Restitution is one of our main programs, gets 28.4%, and land reform similarly gets 29.8%, just to show that the resources are going to the core functions of the department. Per economic classification, we just showed a similar analysis, really. Compensation of employees, we were meant to be at 2.3 billion. We ended up at 2.1 billion rand, which accounts for 23.2% of the total budget of the department. On goods and services, we were meant to be at 1.3 billion. We ended up still at 1.3 billion, and the budget share is 14.3%. That is what we spend on goods and services. Departmental agencies and accounts, it's 2 billion rand, it stayed the same. The budget share is 21.9%. The next prominent line item there, standard item is households. Households, this is where we disburse funds for the core programs of the department, be it land reform, be it restitution. 4 billion rand is what we were meant to receive. We ended up with 3.8 billion rand, which accounts for 40.3% of the budget of the department, which just shows that the money is really spent on the core functions of the department. In earlier discussions, it had already come out that there was some reductions insofar as what was intended and what we have received. We have shown that through the slides that we spoke to earlier on, but in terms of the numbers, for instance, 280 million rand was reduced from restitution grant allocation to respond to a baseline reduction effected by the National Treasury due to the economic outlook of the country, as I had said earlier on in response to a question. That was for the 2014-15 financial year. And further indicative amounts of 40 million for administration, 30 million for geospatial and cadastral services, and 100 million rand for rural development were reduced for 2014-15, also due to the economic outlook of the country. I'm sure members would have seen the BRR report that was also referred to in this morning's presentation, where there has been a commitment to continuously speak between ourselves and the National Treasury with regards to the programs of the department, and also in particular with regards to the reopening. As we start the MTEF processes that are about to start in the next month or so, there's commitment from the Minister of Finance that those discussions must be ongoing insofar as the requirements and the needs of the department are, in particular with regards to the reopening of the restitution claims. Chair, we kept it at that. That is our presentation on the budget allocation. Thank you very much.
Any comments?
I hope this is the moment that you said that could put my question. That summary, the analysis of the departmental budget strategy plan, page 6. Earlier, I had this question, but perhaps you know, it has been answered. But I'll still put it because I think the way I structured it earlier was non-financial. Now, this is financial. The second bullet point says, in the third quarter, the government has failed to achieve most of its targets, but has spent most of its budget. You'll see the big difference between where it structured the earlier question and this one. How does this come about? Because I'm sure it does cause a lot of financial turbulence within the department. And as we know, budgets are passed so that a given department can discharge its social duty to the citizens of the country. Now, if money is spent, but you know, where social goals, so to speak, are not achieved, this definitely has to be, you know, looked into, especially at this critical time of looking at the budget for the coming financial year. The second question is on the very next page, that's 7, land restitution. Of 270 claims settled, 47 were rural, and 223 were urban. Now, I'm not necessarily going to ask why that was the case, but what is the department doing about the possibility that this could create the impression in the rural rustics that urban people are getting a fairer share of what the department offers. And so those who are in rural areas, they feel that they are continuously, I don't want to say perpetually, they are continuously disadvantaged. If we've got such a big disparity, you know, in the way in which the fiscal is being spent.
Are you on the budget?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, that document is yours, which was designed to assist you, but the department doesn't have advice. I heard that you're quoting the page. Your document, you must just raise the issue that contains the document, but they don't have it. It's our document as a committee.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Could it be that these are figures that were made up specifically by the committee, or are these figures that came from the department? If the figures that were just made up by the committee, I withdraw. But if it's figures that came from the department, even though it's, the judgment itself is internally prepared, then my point stands. So that's a little bit critical difference. Our own figure? Could it come from? If so, then they are still answered, especially that. We're told that we shouldn't put these questions to the parliamentary support staff, but rather to the department. We're told that we must wait until the department is present. And that's why I kept asking, is this the right time for me to put the questions? Thank you.
Yeah, I think a brief presentation on land restitution is coming, but it will be brief because while we're talking about the broader plan of the department, we're also discussing the restitution program. But a brief presentation will be coming after the budget one. I thought that maybe you are raising the figurative, you know, questions on the budget related to restitution and all this. But the next presentation will be on restitution. I think that is the relevant time to raise the effort and the rollback, the issue of the effort and the rollback thing, the concern that you
are. I understand I'm technically off.
Okay, thank you. In the absence of comments, I think while we're discussing the third plan, we're also, you know, discussing the budget allocation, the reductions, the increases, and the impact that the decrease is going to have on the operation of the department. Can you just get a briefing from the land use? Sorry.
Honorable Mandela. Thank you. I just wish maybe the CFO, maybe the DG, can respond. I'm just a bit worried that the obvious reduction for this financial year in allocation from the fiscus, whether that will have a burst effect on staff, in particular the filling of vacancies. I'm just a bit worried because when there's less staff, there's less capacity, and there's less implementation, successful implementation.
Yes. Thanks, Chair. When this came through, we had to relook. We have agreed with the Treasury that we will reprioritize. We have already reprioritized within the baseline. So we've got a process where the HR team leads us as a department as to the prioritization of posts that are critical at that time to fill, and we work with them to say what is affordable. So no one was laid off, no one needs to be laid off. We're just managing the rate at which we're filling the posts, linking it to affordability and what we need in terms of capacity increases.
Can you also expand on, I think there was a question of spending 100% of the budget vis-a-vis having achieved.
you, Chair, that specific analysis, the point that was made in the morning, was against quota 3. It was saying quota 3 versus linear targeting in terms of movement of the budget. Now, we think that type of analysis is rather unfortunate, because you do have instances where you cannot count a target yet in quarter three because you are still working, but the expenditure will go through. An example is in rural infrastructure, we may be building a bridge and we are continuing to spend, and the expenditure will show by the end of quarter three, but we cannot count that bridge as an achieved target until it is completed perhaps in quarter four. And as a result, yeah, you'll always see that disjuncture. It doesn't take away from a broader discussion that perhaps we can have at a point where we're done with the audit, where the auditors have agreed with us what is our achievement against our budget expenditure. That discussion may still take place at that particular time, but I'm just saying in the one that you saw in the morning, the risk is that you may be comparing two things that you shouldn't be comparing.
I think that we need to take that to the discussion further now and then.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, honourable members, Minister and Deputy Ministers, colleagues. I'm going to be presenting the strategic plan for the Commission on Restitution of Land Rights. And the mandate of the Commission emanates from Section 25(7) of the Constitution, as we all are aware. And the restitution is one of four pillars of government land reform program. Others being redistribution, tenure reform, and development. Restitution of land rights is implemented under the Restitution Act and up to date as amended by the President, who were informed 2 days ago. And the Act establishes the Commission of Restitution of Land Rights and the Land Claims Court. And the function of the Commission is to solicit, investigate claims for land restitution and to prepare them for settlement. The Land Claims Court adjudicates disputes emanating from the restitution process. The vision and the mission of the Commission. The vision is one where we're looking for a Commission of Excellence that ensures effective, efficient, and speedy redress that is provided to all those that were dispossessed through racially based land dispossessions. The mission is that we exist to provide equitable redress to victims of racially motivated land dispossession in line with the provisions of the Restitution Act as amended. The planning context is that the context is for a strategic plan for 2014-19 in line with the National Development Plan, the medium-term strategic framework, and the revised land reform policy legislation and the implementation of the framework, green paper, and other related policies. Rural development and land reform is implemented as part of the reversing the legacy of the 1913-80s Land Act. Restitution planning, therefore, is aligned to the following: the National Development Plan, the National Growth Path, Comprehensive Rural Development, Outcome 7, 3 principles of land reform, which are single land tenure system support institutions, the reopening of the lodgement of land claims for a period of 5 years, and other priorities of government as set out in the State of the Nation Address. Intention is, and the alignment is to address rural poverty. The NDP states that rural communities require greater social, economic, political opportunities, and land reform is one of the initiatives identified to create opportunities for the economic transformation that we seek to achieve. and therefore the restitution program seeks to contribute directly to the NDP goals of building a united country and resolving historic injustices by restoring land rights or providing alternative forms of redress to persons and communities that have been dispossessed of their rights in land as a result of past discriminatory laws or practices. The redress to be provided to the restitution beneficiaries will be a catalyst for development and social cohesion. The strategic plan of the Commission is aligned with the strategic objectives and goals of the Department, and the program is intended to contribute to the priority of a sustainable land reform, and again, as mentioned, through restoration of land rights and redress as a catalyst. We are talking to 1,457 new claims that will be settled. 983 claims will be finalized in this MTF period. There is a difference between settled and finalized. When we talk to settled, we talk to claims that have been approved legally through the restitution process and signed off by the minister as claims that are valid and are ready to be processed and finalized. When we speak to finalization, we talk to where everything that would relate to that specific claim has been done. So, for example, if you were to have to transfer land, that land has been transferred. If we are paying financial compensation, that compensation has been paid to those communities. The program shall contribute to the policy and legislation development, and therefore the reopening and exceptions of 1913 Native Land Act plus the cut-off date policies and legislation. And as we are aware, the amendment for extending the period of lodgement, the legislation amendment that deals with extension of the lodgement period for an additional 5 years has now been assented to by the President. And as of yesterday, we have reopened the land claims process, and currently, Madam Chair, we can say that we have received, as of 4 o'clock today, 113 land claims. The program shall prioritize the settlement of claims, and the focus will also be on the 27 priority district municipalities and also those areas where infrastructure development has been targeted. Our approach is to realize the vision and the mission, and the strategy has three components: the land rights restored in order to support land reform and agrarian transformation by 2019, lodgement of restitution of land rights reopened, and organizational change management. Strategic outcomes and goals for the Commission. One is land rights restored in order to support land reform, as I already mentioned. Second one is the lodgement of land claims reopened, as already mentioned, and the organizational change. The strategic objectives is land restored, redress land rights lost post 1913, and improved governance and service delivery. And the annual targets there on the goals is 4.1 is land rights restored in order to support the land reform, as already mentioned. The target there for 2014 and 2015 is 379, which is a revised target that's settled. Again, the differentiation between settled and finalized. And number of land claims finalized is 239. And we've got a new indicator, which is a phased project. When we talk to phased projects, we talk to the fact that sometimes communities that lodged claims for more than one portion of land, farm, and therefore the farms are often owned by different individuals, and when we negotiate with different parties, and therefore the settlement or negotiation process does not happen in one at the same time. So we will then process that portion where we've been able to negotiate. And so it's one community but claiming, let's say, five farms. So if we're able to deal with farm number one, we will then consider that as a phased mm-hmm. project, because we can't count five claims, because it's one claim of five farms. So it's going to be phase one, phase two, and if we can then finalize all three at the same time, then we count that as one claim settled. So that's why we've got the new indicator, so that we show the movement of our budget, even though, for example, we would say zero claim settled, but two-phase projects, because we can't count the claim as settled if we still have outstanding phases in that one claim. So we set the target there of 53-phase projects, and a number of land claims lodged to be researched. We've acknowledged that we've got some land claims that were lodged in this current phase that are still have not been researched. We are working with various institutions, HSRC and the universities, and our target is 1,445 for 14-15. The other strategy objective was for us to lodge restitution claims for those people that would have the extension that has been recently assigned to, and that was for us to have 14 lodgement sites functional, and we currently, as of today, have 11 that are operational, and the rest will be within the end of the second quarter. Those are the quarterly targets that speak to the previous slide, so I won't go into that. And that is the presentation. And Madam Chair, if I can just say that the reopening is in full swing. All of the provincial offices are on board to ensure that communication is articulated to all our communities. We are currently on with the assistance of GCIS on all our local radio stations, and also in some of the national stations, and as well as TV. We are intending to use mobile units to go to the rural areas to do what we call knock and drops, where we communicate, where the NARASEC actually take citizens' manual, which tells the claimants how to lodge a claim, what is required, also gives them information about the site, and also helps them to prepare so that when it's time for them to lodge, they'll have all the relevant information. So NARASEC youth are going to help us with knock and drops, and also within the period of 5 years, we intend to roll out lodgement units that are mobile, that are going to go to the deep rural areas, so that we're able to take claims from all sectors of society, and especially because in this second time round, we're not issuing any claim forms. Instead, we expect communities or individuals to come to the lodgement sites, because we're lodging electronically, and therefore we want them to bring the information, and we record it electronically, which is why we're saying that the mobile units will then assist those individuals, Nokoko, who are unable to come to the lodgement site, so that we go to them. We will do this through a comprehensive communication strategy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wato. Members, engage in the presentation. Just asking, because specific one and the ones that have been approved.
Mm-hmm.
So if they have been approved, I think we have to finalize them.
Mm-hmm.
But if 379 have been approved,
mm-hmm.
but we finalize 239 due to budgetary constraints or what?
Yeah, mine is on claims by traditional authorities against each other. There have been lots of cases coming from Limpopo where a traditional authority lost the rights on the land to another chief because that chief accepted one of the authorities' act and the one who resisted that powers were taken from him of allocation of some crazy areas. Amazon, that is the field harvesting of wood and lots of other things. So that the powers are taken from this chief by a decree. Just a letter, written that from now onwards we are responsible for this area. Now, and those are some of the claims that are troubling lots of people in Limpopo, particularly in Skukuliland. So I would like to know, is there a team, because those claims will be dealt with differently from other claims, I think so. I think there is a unit that is dealing with that. And what is the progress in terms of dealing with those? Because I don't think they're sophisticated claims. It's the question of giving those people their authority back. Yeah.
Honorable Nkoy.
Thanks, Jay. Just on the targets for this police way. In the claim that has been received before this now of the claim process, is there any sense of how many are those and these targets? They give us a sense by when even that backlog will be resolved. Because I assume that you're going to have some sort of new influx. I say this because we need to have a sense of claims received, when do we think those already in the system will be resolved. Then we have a sense of new claims that are coming in, how long will all that process more or less take. Shouldn't we set targets to deal with those backlog? Like imagine if I had met the 19 period at the time.
In 1998.
And I'm waiting in that process. Now that new claim coming in. Where am I in the queue? That's the one thing about whether we are dealing with the target within reasonable time. Then there's a question that I had asked earlier on when we were discussing with the parliamentary staff. The issue of compensation. As far as I know, and I'm told this is soon the case, I just want to confirm this. When we pay compensation, or what compensation, where communities are not getting land, they're getting financial compensation, do we still use the standard settlement offer, which is basically a fair rate, and it is fair? Unfair and a racist proposition, because when we pay white farmers, as we did with that Mala Mala thing, we pay them whatever we say, it's a market. Okay? White guys get the billions, black households, I know in some instances, share about 5,000 rand. So it is a big policy question, and I think it has financial implications as well, but one has to get clarity on that. So that committee later on perhaps can come into.
Another person.
Thank you, sir. on the right side, page 6, last bullet point, the program shall prioritize the settlement of claims in the 27 priority districts. How are those determined? Who say these are the priority one? As I said, the right side of it. Lighter on the annual MTF targets for strategic goal, point 4.1. To what extent, let's say claims people prefer to take less, and thereafter the department offers to help them to develop their land. Now, to what extent do you stress the value chain? I take it that we all know that on a hectare, if you play around with your value chain, horizontally and vertically, you can actually create up to 41 jobs. Farming is seasonal and so on. That we all, I take it that we all know that. Mm-hmm. To what extent do we help them to see how they can stretch the value chain? The idea here is to incentivize people to say, look, instead of going for cash, which you could go and spend a gravel, buy penny cents, blah, 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 and the golf and whatever, it's all gone. Go for that, because you could, and the government would gain a lot of social political mileage by saying we have managed to create so many jobs out of every hectare after settlement. Now, instead of choosing cash, take the land, and then we will be able to show you over a period of time how you can get, you know, ongoing benefits from the piece of land. Now, so my question is, what extent do we show them, do we spend energy showing them that there is real value, or do we just say, hey, make your choice, this or that? Because that has got an impact on two things. One is fundamental, that people would feel that indeed we got our productive land back. And then secondly, on the other side of the coin is that you then be saving, you know, on money and getting more value for it, because you would be spending over time as you help them, you know, develop. What's happening in my mind is that I'm trying to think out of the box. I'm not just focusing on this, you know. This is our role as an extension of parliament to say, how can we help our people get more value out of this? Because runs and cents quickly, you know, run out. But the last point I want to raise here is the one that relates to the question of once a claim has been confirmed, I'll use that, you know, confirmed all the documentation, their numbers. Okay, a claim has been confirmed, qualified, whatever, 10 years. Now, who has got a right to go and occupy and utilize that land? I'm asking this question because there is a case in hand, and I've been told that, and I'm not asking the House to discuss that. I want to be cautious here. In Hanky, where somebody's claim has been confirmed, validated, let's put it that way. But somebody else, with the assistance of the municipality, moved in, and this is a white person, moved in, and the no arm of government is being helpful to these people to make sure that if anybody must benefit before they're actually paid out, or the claim is finalized, so to speak, and settled, you know, somebody else is benefiting from that piece of land right now as we speak. And it's not the person whose claim has been validated, it's somebody else. And to add insult to injury, this was claimed from a white person, and it's a white person who has moved in to use the land. So how do you protect, you know, the claimant whose claim has been validated before you actually pay? Because we could be sitting here with quite a few such cases, just that this one has been vocal. Thank you very much.
Can you also just assist us to the district is the beneficial, the temple shore, the community is away, that they are more sure. You know, there are lots of things where there are these disputes, they came as a collective, but at the end of the day, you know, three or four people are benefiting. How do we assist, you know, those poor people who are used to care, but at the end of the day, they don't benefit anything. The extra, this, what do you call it? the co-investor. Which also will take into consideration the issue of the national heritage sites and historical.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Can I perhaps defer to the Minister first, and then I'll respond to the technical questions. If the Minister, can I cover all of them? Okay. No, that's fine. Yeah. No, I'll respond. I'll respond. I thought that perhaps Minister wanted to respond to some of them, but I'll respond. Thank you. Thank you very much. On the first question that you asked about the number of claims settled, which is 379, and finalized, which is 239, it does not necessarily relate to the same claims. Remember that sometimes you will settle a claim in the previous year and finalize it in the following year. So the targets might relate to some of the claims settled, and it might be some claims that we are pulling through to the following year, especially the ones that have phased claims. For example, there was a question that was raised around urban claims versus rural claims, the high numbers. In our last financial year, we had quite a high number of urban claims settled, but does not mean that the budget is spent more on the urban claims. In fact, it's the opposite. The budget is spent more on the rural claims, and the urban claims are usually the much smaller claims, and also they are very often ownership claims. What I mean there is that you will have an ERF that is clearly identified in the deeds office, and the history of that family claim or individual claim is easy to assess. And so those are easier to settle and finalize in one financial year, because you go to the deeds office, which is part of the department, it's easy to identify that this land was owned by Mr. So-and-so or Ms. So-and-so, and therefore. But very often it's very small claims. For example, you'll see that in terms of the annual report, last year's report, it's claims that were in the Western Cape that were settled. And mostly the amounts are very small compared to the amounts that we spend in rural claims. So if you talk about phase projects, you will have a claim that you last year settled 4 out of 5, and this year you finalized because you settled now the last set of outstanding claims. There is the question of conflicts as well that will create the delay between the finalization. So even if you settle the claim this year, you might want to finalize it, but because you are not going to transfer land into a CPA that have community disputes or things that need to be resolved, that claim is not able to be finalized until those issues are sorted out. And if I can perhaps then go to the next question around the issues of claims, competing claims by traditional authorities, let me just mention that we receive any type of claim, whether it is a traditional authority that is claiming or individual or community, those claims are dealt with in the same way. If there's a dispute around who is the rightful claimant, those communities are entitled to approach the Land Claim Court for the court to make a ruling on who is the rightful owner of the land. And secondly, the research that we do as communities, as the commission, helps us assess the history of each claim. So by the time we get to a point where a claim is considered as one that is settled, it means that, in fact, by the time we say we want to gazette, it means that the research has helped us to identify exactly who the rightful claimant is. I think that issues around traditional leadership and authority are issues that are outside of the restitution mandate, and there is a separate department that is responsible for dealing with that. But for us, we interpret the lodgement of claims purely in terms of the Restitution Act, and the Act requires that you provide that relevant documentation to prove that you were dispossessed of your land in that specific area. Some communities decide that they will have traditional authority representing them to lodge their claim. Some communities don't, and we deal with that as and when it is presented to us. Prioritization of old claims. We are prioritizing old claims, number one, because it has been legislated that we will prioritize the old claims, but while we deal with the new claims as they come in. We've set targets, and if you look at progression from our previous years, the number of claims that we've been settling or finalizing has been escalating. But again, if you look at the past 3 years, for example, we have made sure that we spend all of the budget that is allocated to us. So very often we are, the amount of claims that we're able to settle or finalize is dependent on the budget that we're able to get. So as the acting CFO has already mentioned, we're continuing to engage with the Treasury so that as we settle the current claims, we're able to deal with the new claims also. On the question of the prioritized districts, the prioritized districts are districts that have been identified by government. I think 2 years ago there were 23 districts. Now there are 27 priority districts. These are the poorest districts in the country. And so we are wanting to make sure that we align with the government imperatives and focus on those claims as well as priority. The issues around the value chain, I will ask the DG to answer, because it's broader than just restitution. And we've got issues around, of course, the disputes with the claimant communities. Those are ongoing that we are trying to resolve. We've got the land rights management facility that provides free legal advice to those communities who have issues around claims. That needs to be resolved. We have other branches within the department that help us with social facilitation, trying to deal with social cohesion issues, but we also say that it's not just the responsibility of the commission, but it's community issues, it's the district, it's private NGOs that need to help communities facilitate to make sure that there's cohesion in the community so that we're able to give them land, because very often, even though we want to transfer, we're unable to transfer because the communities decide to fight. And I mean, one understands that it's about perhaps very often power, but we have systems in place to try and mediate. We try and put subcommittees in place to try and deal with social cohesion issues that need to be resolved before we get to the transfer of the land. We've got the CPA Act that is in place that is supposed to guide how land that has been restituted is dealt with, including how the communities themselves in general are supposed to deal with issues that affect them. I know that currently the CPA Act is also under review so that we tighten up on some of the things that need to be tightened up so that we're able to have a streamlined process there. And in terms of the COI and the SAND policy, as you are aware, Madam Chair, the reopening and the exceptions to the 1913 Native Land Act and policy on heritage sites and historic landmarks the two were separated. We have already started, we've had two sessions now, for example, with the COI and the FEN, where we are engaging them directly for proposals. The idea is that we engage them so that the policy proposals can come from the ground. We had a Kimberley 1 and a Kimberley 2. The Kimberley 2 happened about 2 months ago, where they were able to submit a proposal to the minister for consideration on how they think it would best deal with the issues around the exceptions for the coincidence, and which would be the pre-1913 situation. We're also engaging on heritage sites and historic landmarks. So it's a separate process, it's ongoing, and we have a group within the department that is working on those. I'm not sure whether I've left anything out. Oh, yes, thank you. The reference to the standard settlement offer, we use historic valuation when we compensate communities who were dispossessed, and we then CPI it to the current, and we pay based on that. Standard settlement offer is usually focused on tenancy claims, and even then it's usually individual households. So for example, if you look at a claim in the Eastern Cape, I think it's Pakeni, if I'm not mistaken, we paid the community there around 91 million, and that would then be given to the individual households. I've recently signed off a settlement where I signed off at an offer of 3 million to a family, an individual family of 6. So we look at the historic value, and this is approved by a quality control committee that helps us assess each individual claim, and which is chaired by the CFO. Thank you. DG will help you with that.
Madam Chair, just on the disputes, to add on what the CMCC raised, the land rights management facility is really a stopgap measure, as we said, because we said we are amending the EFTA so that we can institutionalize dispute resolution in the system. But also, as much as there are disputes which arise as because of opportunistic elements who want to take advantage of these resources in the form of the land that gets given to the people, there are other deeper historical issues which bring about some of these disputes. One of them is, for instance, the one of inter-traditional authority claims. That happened, those two communities sometimes may not have been responsible for the conflicts that they are confronted with today. And normal legal processes are unable to assist in those situations. There are three policy and legislative interventions in the program of this parliament. One of them, we have spoken about the amendment of the EFTA, of the EFTA, which is going to institutionalize dispute resolution through the Land Rights Management Board and the Land Rights Management Committee. That is one of the amendments, one of the 5 amendments. The CPA Act itself is being amended to also look at, because some of the conflicts we deal with today are as a result of CPAs that have been established in communal areas where traditional authorities have jurisdiction. where you then have got two forces that start contesting authority and who has got what authority and who has got power to allocate the land. The Act is in the legislative program trying to deal with some of that and looking at how we can minimize those situations where we will not establish those CPAs in those areas. There is policy and legislation in the program for consideration by Parliament. And the final one is the one that deals with communal land, because many, again, generally there are different categories of communal land. The communal land historically that is now, the minister is a trustee, it's in the hands of the state, but it is subject to land claims itself. But there's also the land that we are returning to communities that were living communally, that owned the land communally, and once you start creating CPAs or trusts, you've got this particular issue. So again, that bill is in the legislative program for consideration by Parliament. It's one of those that we said hopefully Cabinet can consider. With regard to looking at all land reform beneficiaries, not just the restitution claimants, benefiting from getting maximum value from the land that gets returned to them, we introduced the Recapitalization and Development Program in 2010, where we said we would set aside the budget of the department, about 25% of the budget of the department, towards providing this support to those who are returning to the land. Obviously, we are restoring and returning more land than the 25% of the budget available. So, but every year we set targets. I think you would have seen in the operational plan that there is also a target, I think, of about 400 of those that will be targeted to benefit from. The other question, other part of the question, is a very difficult one of communities. Well, the commission, when it settles claims, first they have to take, they have got to go through what they call settlement options. They have to workshop the communities on the best possible settlement model. And some communities are convinced that financial land is the best option to go. In some instances, we have found, I think many of the disputes we have today, some of the claims are stalling as we speak. Some even take the department to court, where there's division within the community itself. Others want land, others want financial compensation. So the whole land claim gets stuck. So that's why I'm saying we are exploring these mechanisms that we are proposing in the legislative program to deal with the root causes of those particular problems. Obviously, we don't think they are the panacea, but we do think that they are very an honest attempt at dealing with the root causes. Thank you very much.
Jake, just this is just a question to help inform me better. In the event of a, let's say, an infrastructure development or something which is critical to the infrastructure development program of government, if that is in conflict with the land plan, let's say a harbour is getting built and there's land plans in the area, is there any mechanism in policy to fast track land plans in an event like that? Is there how would the whole land claim situation, how would you deal with it? Or is it a case of the infrastructure development you have to act? How do you normally deal with that situation?
Thank you, sir. I'm not quite comfortable with the answer offered with regard to this case where claim has been converted and now somebody else moves in. And so fundamentally, let me rephrase the question, you know, for the market.
I didn't answer. I didn't answer it.
It's all around the fundamental question of whose interest is the department obligated to protect once a claim has been gazetted? Previous owner, the current tenant, or those of the prospective owner? Whose interest are you obligated by law to protect? That's a fundamental principle that we're dealing with here. It could translate to a policy matter, if you like, but we do need clarity so that we know how to go about this. If there was a gap, this could be a beginning of a process to close that gap. Because I think this can be one of the things. I think I've got a case in point, and I'm not about to ask the institution to discuss that, you know, that case.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I apologize, I actually didn't respond to your question. In an instance where a claim has been lodged and has not yet been gazetted but is in the process, that land still belongs to the current owner, and therefore we can't necessarily intervene. But in a situation where the claim has been gazetted, we in effect then have notified the current landowner to say that there's a claim over this property, which therefore means that if anything is going to happen on the land, for example, the current landowner wants to develop, that landowner has a responsibility to notify the Commission of its intention to develop, and if the development is not contrary or is not going to compromise the claim, then the Commission has can agree to that development. However, if it's a situation that will compromise the claim that has been lodged, then we have a duty then to intervene on behalf of the future landowners, which would be the claimants. So in this instance, if you have a land and if the claim has been gazetted already and you've got one owner leasing or allowing another person to occupy, as long as it doesn't compromise the land claim, then we cannot necessarily say that if, for example, Mr. X can't continue to occupy and then wants Mr. Y to occupy in the meantime, we cannot then say that that can happen, provided that the interest of the future owners is protected. But at the same time, the claimants might decide that they want financial compensation and they don't want. So we would have to assess the case in it. We'll look at the merits of that individual case. In terms of infrastructure that has been prioritized by government, again, we would have to look at the individual situation. We settle cases looking at the history but also at the future plan of the area. And so I don't think that we would then automatically assume that the development of infrastructure is necessarily exclusive to what the claimant community are seeking to achieve. That's why the DG spoke about options workshops. It's there to make sure that we look at the claims, land claims process holistically, and we inform the claimants of any development that government is seeking to achieve in that area, and so that we allow them options. For example, we talk about alternative forms of redress, including alternative land, or, for example, financial compensation for that specific option portion. For example, if roads are going to be going through their land, we can negotiate to pay financial compensation for that portion and give them the balance of the land if it's possible. So again, we look at the specific case. Thank you.
It's an old man.
Yeah.
Mm. I it's it's an old matter which involves the claimants themselves.
Mm.
And then, but then there is a conflict among them.
Mm.
And we're trying to resolve it. On Friday, I'm going there.
Oh, I'm happy news. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
I'm happy.
Colleagues, can we proceed to the next item? Thank you very much, Ms. Gobodi, for the presentation. Ngonya.
That you brought with.
Yes.
Thank you.
can do it.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon to the Chairperson, Honourable Minister, Deputy Ministers, Honourable Members and Officials. We thank you for giving us this opportunity this afternoon to present the Strat Plan and the APP. I will present the overview of the Ingonyama Trust and thereafter speak on the finance issues, the strategic objectives and measurable performance indicators within our program of land management will be presented by my colleague Mr. Pakis. I myself have been visiting this committee over the last 11 years and I see that there are new members here in the committee. I would therefore like to start with the background of the Ingonyama Trust. The Ingonyama Trust is a Schedule 3A national public entity. Our head offices are in Pietermaritzburg and we have one satellite office in Ulundi. This trust was established in 1994 by an Act of Parliament, Act number 3 of 1994. His Majesty the King is the sole trustee of the Ingonyama Trust Board. The trust has 8 board members. The trust is about the largest landowner in KZN, having an extent of 2.8 million hectares of land, approximately 2.8 million. Trust land is geographically spread throughout KwaZulu-Natal. The core activity of the trust is to administer the land for the material benefit and social well-being of individual members of communities living within Ingonyama land. In terms of our strategic plan, we have not changed the mission and vision of the Ingonyama Trust since the last time we met. In determining our strategic plan, we considered a suitable business model which took into account our key activities, key resources, stakeholders, customer segments including beneficiaries. By facilitating agricultural projects and making land available for human settlements, the Ingonyama Trust contributes towards Outcome 7 and Outcome 8 that deals with vibrant, equitable and sustainable rural communities and sustainable human settlements. The Trust is a major role player in effective land planning and administration in rural areas and enhancing productive use of land. We have one major program, which is land management. Our key focus areas are land management and support to traditional communities. We will now discuss the strategic objectives over the medium term, and I will hand over to my colleague, Mr. Pakis. Thanks.
Madam Chair, the Honourable House, Honourable Minister, Honourable Deputy Minister. In terms of the strategic overview of the Trust, the core function of the Trust is to manage land, as it has been indicated. Most of this land is rural land in KZN. The land in question, the tenure rights that we conclude with the respective for the respective occupants or developments that are taking place in the area are comprised of three types. First would be the leases, the servitudes, and development rights that are there. The leases that we conclude are comprised of commercial leases, agricultural leases, leases for public infrastructure, such as clinics, hospitals, prisons, and then the surface rights leases. To do this, we do it with a staff complement of about 24, and we achieve when we do this. With the limited resources that we have in-house. We also, in terms of the other major objective that we have, it's that of managing the land register that we have. We have one register that we manage to protect the assets. And in terms of doing that, we have to do a proper maintenance and update, an updating of the station on a regular basis. The number of land management projects that we have identified and implemented include agricultural projects, infrastructure development projects, facilitation of economic upliftment and of communities. Currently, there are a number of projects that we are busy with in this current year. These entail specific projects in the rural communities, such as in the Obejani agricultural project. We are also addressing the Nongoma land audits, and we're also doing specific, we also have in the process of concluding a planning and cooperation agreement with Mandeni Municipality in respect of the relations that they have with Machonzi. This goes also with Ulun Municipality in relation to the informal system. The benefits of these projects, what are they? They assist the stakeholders in developing the ITP land. They also, in terms of agricultural projects, ensure that we ensure food security and also alleviate poverty. They also, in these projects also provide jobs in certain senses and also skills transfer. The next strategic objective that I'm going to be reporting on is that of human resources management policy. We are going to be developing some, and we've got existing ones, but we are going to be reviewing the existing policies to ensure that they are in line with the updated legislation. we are also looking at legal policies that we'll be implementing going forward as we from time to time face issues of land disputes and encroachment onto illegal encroachment onto land. I think with that will be our that will cover our strategic objectives, and then I'll hand over to Mr. Mayor to conclude.
So the final strategic objective is support to traditional councils in capacity building programs. The final strategic objective relates to the support to traditional councils, wherein we have capacity building programs. For 2014 and 15, we are looking at providing capacity building programs to 43 traditional councils, who will be workshopped on the following matters: the workings of the Ngonyama Trust, including how tenure rights, including the process for tenure rights, the disbursement of funds process. We'll also be discussing with them legislation that affect land ownership in traditional areas, effective land use for agricultural and commercial purposes, and empowering traditional councils on land management skills. For all of these, besides the one on the HR and legal policies, we will be utilizing the internal ITB staff and internal resources. Relating to the HR policies and the legal policies, we will make use of relevant service providers who have this, who have experience in this type of field. To conclude on those, on the strategic overview, we say with the limited resources that ITB has at the moment, we will be able to achieve, based on our experience in the past, these targets are achievable. And if you look at our last year's performances, we did, we ensured that we were close enough to reaching these targets. I will now talk on the financial aspects of the Ngonyama Trust. The Ngonyama Trust Board generates its own income from the leasing of land or self-generated funds, from investment income, compensation from servitudes, and also receives a transfer payment from the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. The total income budgeted for 2014-15 amounts to 55.3 million, of which 68.7% is from self-generated funds, and the balance 31.28% comprises of the transfer payment received from the department. In terms of our policy for disbursement of funds, 90% of our own funds generated for a particular year accrues for the benefit of traditional communities. The following projects are disbursed from this provision. We have educational awards or bursaries. We pay for administrative costs of certain traditional communities. We pay for cultural events, community garden projects, uniforms for scholars. We also provide legal advice to traditional communities and also training of Amakosi, amongst others. Capital expenditure is required for the efficient functioning of the trust. We've set aside 5 million rand for 2014-15 for purchases of movable assets like furniture and equipment, motor vehicles and computer equipment. Capital expenditure comprises of 9.4% of the total budget. At least 28% of the income that we receive is derived from lease income. 17.5% of our income is expected from investment incomes. In terms of our capital expenditure, we have provided that capital expenditure will be paid from ITB own funds. The board is also of the view that we will look into satellite offices in 2014 and 15, and also we are reviewing the organigram so that the human capital is available to achieve our targets. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for the presentation.
Chair, I have a real difficulty with the amount of time that we have to produce this, and I also there's very basic information here, and I certainly would have liked to have seen something like a proper balance sheet, outlining the income of the trust, also looking at what projected income would be going into the future. I mean, I think we're dealing with 2.8 million hectares of a tremendous asset that can be utilized to the benefit of job creation and really transforming a huge part of South Africa's rural economy. I'm a little bit hesitant to even comment because they ask more questions than, I think it's one of those things that I think will start a very, very long discussion, but I'm going to leave it by saying that I certainly would like to see a proper balance sheet with a proper breakdown of where the income is coming, where the expenditure is going, and what type of projections we can look at into the future. What in terms of financial growth, in terms of its business sustainability, what this trust will look like, let's say, in the future. And right now, I can't really make much use of what I see here beyond using it as background information.
Sir, thank you very much. I've been taking so many cups of tea, so I think I must probably say something. I would rather stay away from the politics of the one tract in one province out of nine, though I'm not a politician and just the chair with the come up close to my colleague Honorable Walter. He would what I think any other trust, any other body, any other individual must accept that the constitutional arrangement here, which puts in place the parliament and its extension via the parliamentary committees, and raise it with the trust that I think that they should be aware that at least one member, if I'm not talking on behalf of us all, is uncomfortable with receiving documents at the last moment. Mm-hmm. You know, that it ought not to be the practice. Otherwise, I may say this at risk, but I take the responsibility that we risk making this a banana republic, which we go to parliament just for the rubber stamps and things go through. And therefore, there will really be no framework for the public out there to put in place such institutions and mechanisms. I'm chair, in short, just raising an issue. Perhaps to everyone else who presented in the course of the day, I've been very patient from the day, listening, that presentations ought to be in line with the PSMA. The format and everything, chair. And no less to the trust. I'm also probably disparaging them, if I may say to myself, like my colleague, Oliver Walter, that we need fruitful engagement, fruitful and useful submission, meaningful things, following certain formats, and so on. As it is, I mean, I think both Oliver Walter just the background information to keep, and I do not see much more than that. And really, the board members are quite respectable, ladies and gentlemen, that they try their level best to standardize with PFMA and make submissions in line with PFMA quickly so that we can all be comfortable. Otherwise, it's very difficult to engage impromptu with the information. Thank you.
I think it settles well that these documents have been submitted at the last minute. In fact, the best thing that should have happened is that they should not have been submitted at all.
Mm.
And I'll tell you why. They carry very little meaning. You look at the reason why this trust exists. Principal thing is to manage land. Now, nowhere do we get an indication as to how you spend 50 million to manage. There's something about sales. I don't know whether it's sale of produce or whether it's sale of land. If it's sale of land, isn't the trust risking minimizing its own resources. If it's produce, what impact has that brought to the individual who are supposed to be benefiting from this? It's so scandy, and that's why I say the best thing would have been just not to submit, because you can't do anything about this unless you are not taking your job seriously. I must be brutally frank. This is next to being a joke. This is next to undermining parliament. You can't do this kind of thing with public funds and hope that every party is going to respect you in the National Assembly. As UDM, we register our strongest objection to this type of administration. We're still the fact that earlier we're given a report that actually there's been so much underperformance in the sense of revenue generation that, you know, where the trustees had to be given extra funds. And the question that one raises, that comes to mind, is how do you justify giving more funds to an institution that is so well casual about accounting for public funds? Because if we just casually, or let me say carefully say it's okay, then we're all painted with the same brush, that the committee endorsed this. We do not, as a committee, have a reason to endorse this. That's the blunt statement I want to make. You haven't given us any ammunition. There is a serious disjunction between what the board was established to do and the way it's spending money. We cannot endorse it, folks. It's just out of the question. We need to be saying we are rejecting it. This is too scandalous. Honorable Waters was pretty much courteous. Perhaps because I'm a new rookie, I'll put it back. That's what I want. So simple as all that. There's nothing to discuss here. There is a statement here, just for information, see, background. The trust is the largest landowner in the province. Is that actually the case, or did one want to say is the largest single owner in the province? You know, I do not know. I would love to know. That's the only question I can't even raise to you. It's so scary.
Do I go? No. I share your sentiment. I think in the decay or in the catalogue of policy issues that this committee has to come back to, we need to bring back the discussion on the Ngonyama Trust. I know that is an uncomfortable political question, but if we're going to spend state resources, public resources, on a facility that we are not clear what is it, a mini homeland, is it part of the unitary state? Because I know that the Dalinger, the king of the trust, the section of them, is always wants his new thingy also. So we must find a long-lasting solution to this problem, or to this question at least, so that we are able to speak with some clarity on, okay, let's put that way, that let's put it on the catalogue of matters that we'll have to deal with in this committee.
Honourable members, I think your concerns have been noted, both by the department and the late submission, because it's the department that is supposed to account. Because when you're mature, account to the department, and the department must make sure that
what are we going to use this money for? I think that is what is missing, because that is what we want. We have got money, where are you going to use your money? So that at the end of the day we track. Now we have just indicated that this money, which is our own income, this transfer from the department, and the expenditure is like that. You know, there's no underspending, there's no what, just the figure. Expenditure is the figures of the income. Then it confuses us because we don't know where are you going to use the money. Where do you apply the principle of 90-10? Because 90% of your income must be used for community upliftment and 10% for your operation. But while I was just perusing, I think we are spending more now on your operation than on community, you know, development. There are also reserves, you know. We want, how are you going to develop the community? How are you going to create jobs for the rural people living under the jurisdiction of the Wenyama Trust? How are you going to uplift those communities through the money that you're getting through the leases, you know, all these income generation sources that you have? I think what is missing here, we know that this money is coming from your own fund, this one from the department, but what is it that you are going to do? It can just give us a plan. This is the income, here's the money, so that we can see whether that principle of 90-10 is applying. Because our intention is to improve, you know, the lives of the rural people. Are you using the 10% of the budget for operation, taking the 90%? How do you assist the students? Are you still continuing assisting the students with bursaries? How many projects have you funded? Are you planning to fund? You said one new. But how many projects are you planning to fund in this financial year? The impact of this workshop. Because we can't have workshops for life. We need to make an assessment. What is it that you want to achieve through conducting this workshop? The challenge of the illegal squatting that you have. The Zulu book, I think you remember that one. But you explain when we engage on the annual report. We want to know, here's the money that you said you have. Where are you going to spend the money? That is what we want to know. In this financial year. I think that is what is missing. I don't know whether there's anything that can leave it out. Because out of the documents, we can't say they must touch afresh. Yeah. But when looking at the documents, there's an information that is available to us. But they must just provide us with the additional information that will give us the light. Where are they going to spend the light? Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, we must apologize for the delay in the submission of the documents. We submitted three documents, Chair. First one is the presentation. We submitted the annual performance plan, and we submitted the strategic plan. If you look on the very last pages of the strategic plan, the strategic plan itself, you'd find a breakdown of expenditure detailing exactly what we'll be using the monies for. In the past, we did present the entire budget with notes explaining the expenditure of the trust. However, with the new PFMA, it even limits us to and restricts us from doing that. Therefore, the presentation is in the manner in which it is. If you look at prior years, there was very detailed information of the budget and the spending of the Wenyama Trust. Whereas now it talks about economic classifications, goods and services. However, we can make that available to you, and we will address these issues in writing to the committee. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for Thank you very much, Madam Honourable Member. Honourable Minister and Deputy Minister, for being part of us until this time. We know that you're going to have a program, but you decided to come to this committee. I'm Wenyama Trust on Wednesday, yesterday. We don't start everything afresh, but you feel the gaps. I think I've just made some highlights. Something that you've done, but you must come and present it and attach it correctly. Then we'll consider that and proceed with other matters. Honorable members, I think we've come to the end of this meeting. Pumla indicated that the dinner in the new wing restaurants there in Cape Town. Most of the people are staying late now. We don't have time to cook. You are tired from morning, you have been here. So the meeting is adjourned till Wednesday. Thank you very much.
I was destroying the park and all the ventilation.
Yeah.
And they are the ones that told us to dig it up.
Oh, yeah.
I'll show you. All the parks and all the ventilation. They are the ones that told us to dig it up. All the parks and all the ventilation. They are the ones that told us to dig it up. The The chair must be here.
Yeah.
No way I'm going to come here again.